Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. Today we are doing a follow-up episode to the Mytrese Richardson episode, and I have a very special guest with me, Dr. Rhonda Hampton. Hi, Dr. Rhonda.
Hello. Such a pleasure.
I'm so glad that you are here. Thank you for sitting down with me.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you so much for covering Mytrese's story. It's just we need things like this in order to keep the information out there.
Yeah. So first, I guess I will ask you to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and maybe how you and Mytrese first met and your friendship with her.
So I am a licensed clinical psychologist, and I'm have a private practice. So I met Mytrese when she was completing her senior year in college and getting her degree in psychology. So the school that she attended, which we both attended, Cal State Fullerton, right? So so we had that in common. So the school that she attended, you have to do what's called a field placement in order to graduate. And so that's basically similar to like an internship. So you have to work at some agency or, you know, something to collect enough hours so that you can graduate. Mytrese was originally, she loved children and she wanted to be a child psychologist. And so originally she was at a placement that was working specifically with children, but it fell through at the last minute. And I honestly think it was within, like, she was going to start school within a week or two, which meant, you know, that would have significantly impacted her ability to graduate. So she called the office, and my office manager, you know, who loves a sob story, agreed to at least talk to me about taking on an intern, which I had no interest in whatsoever. So my office manager, who, by the way, is my big sister. So,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, you know how that went.
Oh, my gosh.
Because, you know, because it's quite a commitment in my mind to take on an intern. And it's just like a life bonding experience. Yeah. And so at least I see it that way.
Yeah, because as an intern, she would be pretty much by your side the whole time.
Yes. And beyond, because, you know, it's just a lifelong commitment to someone. And I have other interns over the years, but yeah, so I agreed, you know, because, you know, the situation was just kind of, you know, she's got to graduate. And but, you know, I had an attitude about it. I was not happy about it. It's like, I'll do this thing, but I met her and I fell in love with her within 5 minutes. So it was all wonderful.
What was her personality like?
And that's the thing that's interesting, very different from mine. So she was very bubbly, like very, very compassionate, very, very bubbly, very happy, and very smart. So in that kind of deceiving way, where sometimes you'll meet people who are just, you know, and she was drop dead gorgeous too. So she's this beautiful woman, so sweet, so just full of life. And so you don't really get their intellect until you sit down and talk to them. She was definitely one of the smartest interns that I've ever worked with. And I was a little intimidated by that, honestly, because when I was in her position, I definitely did not have the skill set that she already had that came naturally. So in many ways, I thought, okay, I don't know what I'm going to teach this girl, you know? And so I almost had to kind of do things differently with her than I would have, you know, other interns. She was just ready for much more than the average person in her position. So, and I think that also got, you know, that really created a pretty strong bond between her and I, because I was entrusting her to do things that, you know, other people in her experience level would not have, like attending court sessions with me and attending meetings and delving into cases.
Very personal. And
very personal. And then taking on a lot of, you know, like she was just ready for a lot of, to learn a lot, and she soaked everything in. So, you know, it was a very quick bond.
Oh, so when do you think you saw her kind of change where maybe you thought, maybe something's wrong?
I would say, So the field placement is like an entire school year. Maybe 3 months in or so, I noticed she seemed a little stressed. She was a little bit, I think she came into the office a little bit unkempt sometimes, and it was really subtle things. And then that might happen for a weekend and it would be gone. You know, like maybe I'd see her on a Friday. It's like, this doesn't look good, but by Wednesday, you know, she's looking fine. And that happened like maybe twice in like, you know, a 3 or 4 month period, enough that I had to have a conversation with her, and was kind of along the lines of either you're very stressed out right now because it's your senior year, or you might have some other mental health issues, so I want you to go get it checked out. And she did.
Yeah, I was going to ask, was she responsive to that in a positive or negative way? Or, did she take it offensively or was she open to it?
Oh no, she was not offended by it at all. She was very open to that. And at her school, they had a counseling center. So, you know, it was pretty easy to go get checked out. She was concerned that I was saying these things to her enough that she knew
Yeah.
that, you know.
Well, as a psychologist, if a psychologist is, telling you that and somebody that you trust and probably look up to like a big sister, I would imagine it would probably be like, okay, I need to take this seriously.
And I think I know the first time that she went, she just said, I went and they said things were fine, but to check back, to check back again. And I know that she did go back again before school ended, and I don't know the outcome of that.
Yeah.
I do want to share with the listeners that there was a beginning. One of the things that's important to me as a psychologist is just the education of all of this. How do we, beyond the legal aspects, what else can we learn from her case? And that's, I would just say how to get help and how to recognize certain signs. Now, when she was in my office, it was so subtle. If you weren't a psychologist, you probably wouldn't even think anything was wrong.
Right. And that's kind of, I barely ever put opinions in my episodes at all. But this one, when it comes to mental health, it's something that I get extremely, if I don't get it out, it will just eat me alive. And you can be around somebody all the time and just think it's mood swings or something like that. And that's kind of what I was thinking. Like, how do you determine what's a mood swing from what could be bipolar or something like that?
Right. So like when she was in the office, it was just really subtle. So, if you say, oh, like you look kind of disheveled today and you just don't quite seem yourself, that's not enough for someone to think that there's a
Yeah.
mental health issue. I mean, I think if you're, but it happened enough that, of course, I'm going to say, go get this checked out. But as time went on, once she graduated, there were behaviors that were very, very clear that something was going on. And I think it's just more people being informed. For example, on the day before she went missing, she actually showed up to Cal State Fullerton. She went to the office of a professor that she really admired and really looked up to. And apparently that professor was like maybe teaching classes. She wasn't available. But from what I'm told is that Maitri sat there for in excess of an hour waiting for this professor to show up. And so when she did, she approaches the professor who adored Maitri also. And Maitri talked about some book that she was going to write. And, from what the professor tells me, some very unusual statements he was making, enough that alerted the professor to want to get Maitreese some help. But what she did is she walked Maitreese to another, like a psychologist, who was not there. And Maitreese kind of got wind of what was going on, and so she ran away. So in that moment, that professor knew something was wrong. And what immediately should have happened is she should have called security, because you have a woman on campus acting very strange, and you know it enough that you have to go get her help. Well, there are systems in place in that environment to get her help. I guess one could argue that technically Maitreese wasn't a student anymore, so maybe technically they didn't have to call security. My thinking is that it just didn't occur to the professor to do it, because she certainly was trying to get her help before she ran off.
in the episode, I know I had read in the newspapers that they said that she hadn't slept in 5 nights. Do you believe that's true?
I do, because while I was definitely not a person who was active on social media at that time, so it wasn't something that I was constantly on. When I did get access to her social media, it is very clear what is going on. Her statements were bizarre. She was posting practically on 24 hours. I mean, she was constantly posting over several days. And if I had have seen that stuff, I definitely would have, honestly, would have thought she was bipolar. And I would have, you know, said, you know, she needs to get some help. Now, her friends are trying to intervene and checking in on her, but I just don't think that they got what was really going on. And that's where the educational piece comes in. Like, how do we teach young folks? Like, if you see these things, these are the options. Her mother, because I believe if, you know, if her friends would have called her mother, or her mom would have jumped in and, you know, tried to get some help. Mom was not, you know, aligned with her on social media. So mom wasn't looking at that stuff or seeing that, yeah, those kinds of things.
And she was living with her great-grandmother or grandmother at the time?
Yes, she was living with her great-grandmother at the time. So,
oh, okay. Yeah. And I think her friend said, like, it wasn't unusual for her to stay in her car.
Her day, like, even when she was an intern, her day would be going to school, coming to her internship, coming to my office. She also worked at, as an administrative assistant, so doing that. And all this was, like, you know, you got Fullerton, Diamond Bar, LA, or Santa Fe Springs. So it's just, I think it was just more convenient to live with her grandmother. But yeah, she was in her car a lot because she's having to, you know, change for school or go to internship or do these kinds of things. So if you saw her car, she definitely appeared to be living in her car. And her and I had many, many conversations about that.
And now that you really explained it that way, it's like, okay, I get it. I get why her car would look like they said it did, because she's got all this stuff going on and you're in your car all the time. It's going to get kind of junky and messy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think hers was at that point, I didn't see her car when they you know, impounded it, but I definitely saw her car when she was working at the office. And, you know, it's like, my dreams, at least put stuff in the trunk. Like, you know, that,
yeah,
like, I get you're moving around a lot, but this is ridiculous.
So what are some of the signs we should look for?
I think, you know, drastic changes in behavior, you know, even like a style of dress. So let's just say, you know, all of a sudden the person, they wore bright clothing all the time. And then next thing you know, they're very, all wearing all black, or even the opposite, you know, so whatever that might be, you know, being periods of time when they're a lot more risque than otherwise, you know, just fluctuations in their mood. And it doesn't even have to be between happy and sad. So fluctuating between, you may, maybe happy and angry, or angry and anxious. So in any, you know, kind of fluctuation in their mood, where they seem unpredictable for periods of time, periods of time where they may be isolated, that they won't come out of their room, that they sleep for days and days and days at a time, and you know, they won't get out of bed, or they don't have the energy, they're not interacting with anyone. Honestly, I think any unusual behavior, I think we as humans have an instinct when something is going wrong with someone, but we haven't really been encouraged to speak about that. Because some of that could just be asking the person, hey, what's going on with you? Like, is something going on? And if you're not getting a response that makes sense, then reaching out to their loved ones, you know, like, hey, check on your kid. You know, someone who may be in a position to speak more openly to the person about their behaviors. But honestly, I would say any drastic change in someone's behavior is enough to check in with them and say, what's going on?
Yeah, and you would think that would be the kind of instinctive, normal thing to do. But I don't know, some people don't. But for me, it would be like if I saw one of my friends obviously going through something, it would be just instinctive to say, hey, what's going on? Are you okay? Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes though it looks like, you know, like their behavior is within normal range, but it's not normal for them. And that's the thing that we're looking at. So it's not like they have to be something that's doing something that's so outlandish. It's just like, wait, what's going on with this person? Because they're acting a little bit different than what they normally do. So it's probably the best way to kind of look at it.
So do you think when she drove out to Joffrey's, the restaurant, do you think that she had a mental break because she stayed up for so many nights and she was already kind of struggling? And it seems to me that she just, it was just kind of instant and not something that you could have maybe predicted was going to happen, but like it was a slow build up to a mental breakdown.
I think that just in looking like now and having much more information, right, than I did at the time, what I think is that she, first of all, when it comes to bipolar disorder, or she was about that age, women somewhere 22, 24, where you're kind of going to see that. So she was kind of like at the age. So probably when she was at my office, it was the beginning. But you know what? I get it. When they got her checked out, she was fine, because you're not acting like that all the time. You know, if you have an episode once or twice a year and it's mild, no one's going to even notice it. But by the, but it's a progressive illness. So by the time, you know, a couple years later, I believe this probably was her first full blown, you know, episode. And it just happened, unfortunately, on that day where nobody was able to intervene. She was already acting bizarre when she went to Cal State Fullerton. And unfortunately, they didn't intervene, I guess. She also was acting that way at work. So she went to her job and she was acting, you know, and they describe in a bizarre manner, just different from her, just kind of erratic in her behavior. She, on that same day, she did meet up with a couple of friends and she, you know, they describe her as acting odd. And then, you know, she goes off to Joffrey's. So I believe that over that week period of time, and the 16th, of course, being, you know, where it really hit the head, I believe it was slowly building up. And it probably was a first, you know, full-blown manic episode.
Gosh, that's so sad. And you know, just to think that she was so far away from home and having this mental breakdown. And it's kind of like, you know, she's all alone. She doesn't know anybody. And then the police come and get her. I mean, I can't imagine what goes on in a person's mind when this is happening. I mean, it may have caused her more panic when she's going to a jail and she has no car since they towed it. She has nothing. I can't imagine that.
And it's hard, you know, in her, it's hard to know what she was realizing, what was going on, because I have since had the opportunity to speak with some of the employees who were there at the restaurant, and they describe her as bizarre, but friendly and just kind of oblivious to what was really happening to her. So, you know, when they're arresting her, I don't know if she really understood all of what was going on.
Yeah. And one point, they gave her a field sobriety test. And it's like, if you know she's acting bizarrely enough for you to test her for substances, then, and you see that comes back normal, then wouldn't they think something deeper is going on? And is it normal for police to not do that and just hold someone until for a couple of hours, then let them go? Is that normal?
So here's the thing about that. There's discrepancy as to whether or not there was actually a field sobriety test. So the officers who were there, the lead officer, which was Armando Luaro, states that he never requested for a field sobriety test to be done. And he didn't believe that there was one done. The valet who was there also standing by the side of the officer said that he was with Maitrece the entire time and he never saw them give her a field sobriety test. So even during their own depositions, of which I was there, it's who, I don't know if there actually was a field sobriety test. When one officer says that there was, another said that there wasn't. A witness says that there was not one given. What the witness, the valet also said is that what the officer said to him was, oh, I know what's wrong with her. She's a ding. And a ding is what the LASD uses for someone who has a mental health issue. They probably knew that the arresting officer or the lead officer probably didn't order a field sobriety test because he thought she was a ding, as he stated.
Wow. So I wonder what protocol is when you pick up someone that, okay, you think they have a mental illness, then should you be letting them go at a little bit after midnight, off into the night with no ride?
Yeah, so to begin with, is that officer, the lead officer, he was at the end of a double shift. He was ready to go home. And it was right.
And that's more important than.
because when they recommend for a 5150 evaluation, which would have meant either them taking her to the hospital to get evaluated or calling someone to come out to the jail to evaluate her, the officer has to stay with her the entire time. So if you've already
worked, just ready to go,
I would imagine you've already worked a double shift and you want to take her to, you know, the hospital and then have to wait to see what they're going to do with her. In all likelihood, with Maitrice, what would have happened, in my opinion, and I worked for many years inside of a psychiatric hospital before I was in private practice, we probably would have evaluated her. She probably not have been unstable enough to keep her. However, she probably would have been medicated and her parents would have been called. She wouldn't have been released.
Exactly.
Yeah. So whether a 5150 would have held with her or not, I don't really think so. But she would have been held long enough to where she would have gotten some medication and where she would have gotten someone to come and pick her up.
I had some of the recordings in my episode of her mother who said, if I need to come get her, let me know. And they acted like they were going to keep her all night. And to not even let her mother know after she's called and said, you know, she has no ride, I will come get her, that seems very, very wrong.
So that station's a very small station, and I think it's they're just very lackadaisical about things. And clearly they had not done any kind of end of shift report because the individual who answered the phone didn't even know who Maitrice was.
That was, to me, it was so cringy and frustrating. I was like, you don't even know she was in your station? Like, what is happening?
Well, and I don't know where, the station is very, very small. So literally, he probably could have just turned around and or asked the jailer if she hadn't arrived yet. Hey, is somebody on their way? Or if she was there, he could probably see. I've been to that jail and toured it several times. I know the cell that she was in, and I know how close it is to where the phones are being answered. So they just don't communicate with each other because, you know, indifferent and lazy.
In your opinion, do you think there is anything to the deputy on video walking out after Maitrice left? Do you think there's anything to that? Kind of what's your opinion on what happened after she left, maybe?
We were originally told that there was no officers at that station, that the only person that was there was the watch commander and the jailer, you know, after the arresting officer brought her there, so that there was no one else there. That doesn't make any sense, but fine. We later find out, you know, like about 4 months later, that there was at least one of our other officers there because we were able to see the video and we see the officer walking out behind her. So, you know, you get suspicious, like, well, were you guys lying? And there, you knew that there were officers there, or did you not know? Like, why is this information inconsistent? I found out just a year and a half ago that there was more than him. There were six other officers in that station.
Wow.
And and I saw it on video. So I was able to see the video again, and I saw it in more detail than I had seen it previously. And there were at least six other officers there.
Wow.
It just baffles me what could have happened with her. So the officer who walked out, who I have now learned is actually Jose Perez, I don't know what he was doing. I know that him and his partner, Ishmael Rodriguez, were relocated pretty shortly after we saw that video for reasons unbeknownst to me. We don't get to know much more information. The officer did claim that that they didn't see her when she left. I don't know how they didn't see her when she left.
Yeah.
Unless they drove out of the station and made a left and she made a right. You know, I don't know. So it's just more suspicions, you know.
Yeah. And especially when you kind of obviously catch them in a lie, it's like, okay, how am I supposed to trust anything you say? So in the beginning, as I was researching, I thought, okay, this is seems like a case of, you know, a mental breakdown and possibly getting lost, falling. You know, I've never seen the Malibu canyons before. So in my mind, I was thinking maybe she fell. She just got lost, confused, fell, and unfortunately passed away there. And then when I got deeper into it and saw, okay, this cop's getting arrested and going to jail, and so is this one, and they were involved with the so-called investigation, and also the coroner said, supposedly, it was in the paper that I read, you know, do not touch her remains until we get there. And they claimed they never got that memo. And that is very hard for me to believe. What are your thoughts on this whole, I don't, from the coroner telling them not to touch her, from finding her, what are your thoughts?
What I think is this. Either one of their own was directly responsible for what happened to Maitrece, and they are trying to cover it up every step of the way. Or they think one of their own is responsible.
Yes.
So they're trying to cover it up every step of the way and making lots of sometimes mistakes and then sometimes intentional withholding of information or suppression of information in the case of the captain hiding the videotape in his desk.
Yes. Why was he promoted after hiding a videotape? I guess we should back up and kind of discuss that because that is huge. I also read that there was an unedited video and one that was edited. Is that true? Were there two different videos or had it been edited?
Well, a few things about the video. So on the occasion that Maitrece went missing, the captain was not working. And what I recall at the time, he was due to leave for vacation. But instead, he finds out Maitrece is missing. He comes back to the station in just enough time to pull the video from the queue and he put it in his desk and then continued to lie to friends and family of Maitrece as well as the media about the even existence of a video. So he stated that it did not exist. Only because that doesn't make sense did we keep saying, come on, you got to have some video of her.
Yeah.
At some point, there's a lot of great people in the community. And at some point, I got an email from someone who was very familiar with the station. He was in law enforcement, but he did not work for LASD, but he was from another law enforcement agency, but he had the occasion to go to that station. So he was able to describe it to me. He wrote out this letter saying, you need to get a meeting with Lee Baca and somebody needs to read this and then they'll have to admit that they have it. I wrote out what he said, printed it out. I gave it and we got a meeting, myself, Lauren, Latisse. And we just said, okay, whoever has the opportunity to jump right in and read this letter, then this is the way that we're going to request the video. And all it was saying, you know, it's just very comprehensive. Do you have any video, audio, inside, outside, you know, like the perimeter, the exterior, like we just every single way in which you could request it. And then Tom Martin was there. And at that moment, he admitted that he had the video. Maybe they were going to admit it anyway. I have no idea. But at that point is when they admitted that he had it and he had it in his desk. And Lee Baca, his face, he was so angry. You could just see
anger
all over his face. And so that's how we found out. And he was subsequently promoted to, I can't remember the exact position, but he would have been the head of the homicide who would have been overlooking Maitrece's case.
Okay, I see. If I can't trust you with a videotape, how am I going to, you know, trust any? I mean, this is just so deceptive. And how are you not supposed to have suspicions and questions? And if you do, they should be able to answer these things and not have anything to hide about it. Just answer the questions and show me proof. Right.
Well, and so then there's a time that when he admits that he has the video. So, of course, the next thing we want to do is to see it. That took oh my gosh, maybe another, maybe 3 months, 2 or 3 months, something like that, before they would allow us to see it. And so what it is this is that the video is recorded on four different tapes. They called QuickTime files or something like that. So they took those and they combined it into one, and then they edited it down to a way where they could show it to us for whatever reason. So that's how they showed it to us. So we never saw the original files, just what it was that they wanted us to see. But what happened was, on the day that it was myself, Lauren, Latisse, Chip, who's another volunteer, a couple other family members. On the day that we were allowed to see it, we see her in the video, we see her there, not, and then what happens is the screen goes black. So you think it's the end of the tape. Of course, now we're angry. So we're like, I thought you said there was no tape, and here she is on tape, and it's pitch dark out there. So we're saying all this. I don't know if you've ever been into a preschool room. They'll sometimes In the old days, they'd have that round table. The teacher would be in the middle, and all the kids are kind of around. If you imagine that scene, the person who was showing us the video was there. So the technician was right in the middle, and we were all kind of surrounded. The screen's going black. We're all arguing about it. He looks at me, and he like nods his head to look up. So I look up because, he got my attention. My Teresa's cousin also looked up. And the next thing we know, we see the jailer who had walked my Teresa out into the darkness. We see her walk back. As soon as she shuts her door, we see another door open. And that's when we see the deputy walk out. And that's how we found out that there was another person in the jail. Because if you would have saw it, you would have not thought that you would have thought it was the end of the tape. The homicide detectors were there. They clearly either didn't know that there was somebody else there, or they were shocked that it wasn't caught out and that we saw it. So then that even brought more, like, wait a minute, you guys said that there was nobody at that station. Who is that guy? Which they never actually told us who it was. We kind of had to find out on our own. So that was like 2010. And then, like I said earlier, I got to see it again a year and a half ago. So, and when I saw it this time, it was a different video. I mean, the basics were the same, but I saw it was a lot more clear. It included things that I didn't see during the first video. It included people. So now I see that there are people there. The person who was showing me the video named the people. She gave me their names of who were there because she had worked at that station, so she knew who they were. And that's how I found out that it wasn't Ishmael Rodriguez who followed after my tree, said it was Jose Perez. They were partners, though, and riding in the same car. So when you have that many lies, you have a captain of a station who pulls a video, puts it in his desk, lies to everybody about it. Finally, when they show us the video, we're seeing something that clearly people didn't want us to see. And now, so many years later, I'm even looking at more of a video than what originally. We also learned this too. All the while the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department was saying that there was no video, the Los Angeles Police Department had portions of that video. So they were colluding with the lie from the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. So somewhere around 2 weeks after my trees went missing, the LAPD was afforded some portions of that video. So when they're hearing news reports talk about there's no existence of a video, and they hear us screaming for this video, the LAPD is also guilty of hiding the fact that there was a video. I do want to say this. There was a reporter from, was it LA Magazine, who did he did speak to Ishmael Rodriguez, and he called him once, and Ishmael like basically hung up and said, "Don't come back, don't call me back again." And but he called him again, and then Ishmael made the statement that's always concerned me. He made the statement that I was one of the ones who stayed away from that nonsense. So my thing is, what nonsense did you stay away
What nonsense?
from? It's your job to get involved with nonsense. That's your job. So I don't know what nonsense. Who knows what he meant by that, but I want to backtrack a little tiny bit just for some history. So when she first went missing, I don't know how else to say this, but it was kind of like before Black Lives Mattered. So there was no Black Lives Matter movement. There was no one really of any concern about, with a Black missing girl. It just wasn't. That's just how it was. So as a result of that, when she first went missing, there was a lot of backlash that we got from publicly for blaming the law enforcement, you know, for anything. And, you know, we were just angry Black people. And so there was so much of that there. And there wasn't a lot of support from the media either. You know, the sheriffs, they have their media, you know, team, and they were able to get all that. They were able to set the narrative, right? So right. We had one lone newspaper, the Malibu Surfside News editor was probably the only person, or at least in the beginning, who really believed in what we were saying, believed that there was something there. So other than that, we didn't really have a lot of media support, and we didn't have a lot of public support. I just know we didn't have a lot of support. So a lot of what we were doing was just getting volunteers together who would be willing to help. So we would, you know, slowly were able to build a team of people who would kind of help. One of those people, this is where I was going. One of those people was a volunteer from, it's called the Los Angeles County REACT team. And these guys just do a lot of assistance with radio patrols. And, you know, if there's a disaster or something, they're providing kind of the radio technology. So one of the individuals who was on that volunteered, he volunteered with us also. He helped with hiking and searching and things like that. They scan the radio because if there's something that goes on, they provide support. So he actually called me and said, listen, there was a body that was found. It was a partially mummified naked skeletal remains is the way that he said it. And it's in the proximity of where my trees went missing. So, you know, you guys might want to come out here. And he gave me more or less where it was. I immediately called my Teresa's mom, called her aunt and said, this is what's going on. From there, her aunt called the lead detective in the case. And he said, you know, there were a few bones found, but we don't think it's my trees, and it really doesn't have anything to do with my trees. Okay. I don't believe that. So we head out there anyway. We get there. There's like the media is already there. It's like a full on thing. Right. And all the homicide detectives are there. And so we've been to the area. I mean, if it wasn't my Teresa, come on. And why are you saying that it was just a few bones when this guy has the radio transmission and is saying it's a partially mummified remains naked? We know the likelihood is that it's her. Yeah, so that's actually how we found out. So and they still wouldn't admit that it was her. They said, you know, we don't know if it's male or female. We don't know, you know, the race of the person. All the while they had the clothing. While she was, you know, she was naked, but her clothing was, or there was clothing found in the creek bed that they assumed was hers. You know, there was Afro hair. At the time, there was this Caucasian male around, I think I want to put him somewhere between 40 and 50 who had been missing years before. It clearly was not him. So they, you know, they just tried to convince us that it was not her. And they were encouraging us to leave, to go home. And we wouldn't. And we just stayed and stayed and stayed for hours until finally we see the helicopter airlifting something out of that canyon. Turns out that it was my trees. When we saw that, they still tried to get us to leave, and we wouldn't. And our intentions was to stay there as long as they did. And yeah. So at some point they gave up. What were they going to do? So they started to leave, and I can't even remember how many canines and so many vehicles were coming out of this property. So my Teresa's body was found adjacent a porn ranch. Right. And so, it had a private road. Well, they were using that private road to access the creek bed where her body was found. So the cars, when they were driving out, were driving out of that private residence.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you know if that's a place that had been searched before? Because I have, you know, my own questions in my mind. Is this the place she originally was, or did y'all search before there and there was nothing there, and then all of a sudden here's her remains? Or do you think she had been there the whole time? Maybe,
you know, I don't know, and I have a lot of I don't knows. It would be strange. Well, I do know this, that particular creek bed, if you don't know the area, it could be difficult to access. But if you do know the area, it's much easier, which is why it is a known marijuana grow. So when they talk about how remote it is, it's like, well, those marijuana growers know how to get up there. I saw the irrigation hoses. I saw the whole mountainside. It's not that inaccessible. You just have to know the way in which to access it. So when her body was found in that particular area, how long it had been there, I don't know. Was it placed there? Was she there the whole time? The person who is the head of the Malibu search and rescue at the time, his name was Tui Wright. And so he was in charge of all of the searches. He also was on the marijuana eradication team. So if you know this is where the marijuana growers are, and you know there's a missing woman, and this is, we know she was last seen in Bill Smith's backyard, which is about, about a mile and a half from where she was found ultimately. Seems to me you're the head of search and rescue. The bed of water is probably going to be the first place that you're going to look, right? Where illegal activity goes on in terms of marijuana, you think that that's going to be the first place you're going to go. But not only that, what Tui Wright told me, the way searches go is that you pinpoint where you think the person was last seen, and you search within a 3-mile radius of that area. So why that area? There are many reasons why that area should have been searched. And who knows? So, and I don't know if it was searched, they didn't find her the first time. And if it wasn't searched, then maybe she was there the entire time. But there's questionable behavior going on either way.
Yeah, because I know you're not going to know the answers, and neither am I. But I can't help but have these questions of, could it have been somebody at that porn ranch that did something to her because they saw her at a certain place, a certain time? Vulnerability, that happens a lot. And maybe, you know, if a police officer knows one of them, knows something happened at that ranch that went wrong, or maybe was an accident, and maybe the police know them. There's just so many ways this could go. Mm-hmm. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, I think from like an investigative standpoint, I'm not an investigator, but I would think, I'm going to play an investigator right now. I would think that there are three critical areas that are of concern and with regards to the searching for her, Maitreese. And that would be, we know for a fact that she was last at the sheriff's station. So that one would think that there would, at the very least, be a 3-mile search within that radius. That would be a very critical point. Are there any known offenders in that area that she could have walked past that area? Like, there's a park. There's all kinds of things. It's kind of more like a lot of warehouses there, but there are some apartment complexes and a park. But within a 3-mile radius, okay, then let's look and see if that's a place where she, when she first went missing and you didn't know where she was, why wouldn't you search there? Why? And if you claim she walked, get the dogs out there so you can see in what direction that she, which way she walked in the first place, right? And then Bill Smith's backyard, where we, that was most likely her. The 3-mile radius there would have definitely been included the creek bed. And the head of the search and rescue team is very familiar with that area. Not searched. The porn ranch itself is like 20 acres or something like that. You know, so these are three critical areas that are important to, you know, to search. So whether you and I know what happened or not, common sense would tell us these are the important areas that we would check. Instead, they're going to send teams out to Las Vegas to look for her on the strip prostituting.
Right.
But not any money or time in the area where she was last seen. And even when you hear about this expansive search that they did, it literally starts at Payuma Down, meaning the area where she would have made a left turn to go into that backyard, never searched that area. It started from the creek, from Malibu Creek State Park down to the ocean, as opposed to within the 3-mile radius where she
is.
So Tui Wright, the head of the search and rescue team, conveniently decides to start the search below the area where she was last seen.
Yeah, and you can't deny you're veering away from that area on purpose.
He was veering away from that area on purpose. On the day of that big search, it was in January of 2010, they brag about it. It was just a photo op.
Yeah, and in the papers, it was like, this is the biggest search we've ever had in the history of this county or something like that.
By the way, those people, those are all volunteers who get paid $1. So it's not like all this money. But they had this big like mobile unit that was their command post there at Malibu Creek State Park, and it had this big map that had all the areas that they were going to search. And so they brought us in to say, here, this is what we're going to do. And so when they showed us the area, Latisse and I were like, wait a minute, why are you starting here? Why not start from the sheriff's department and work your way down and include Montanito, where you know she was last seen? And Tui Wright, the head of the search and rescue, he said, well, we're going to start here and work our way down to the beach. And if she doesn't turn up here, then I promise you, we are going to eventually search this entire area. And we pleaded with him, like, that doesn't make any sense. And by then, Tui had taught me a lot. And I was like, Tui, you told me yourself that you start searching in a 3 mile radius of when the person was last seen. So to me, that is either the sheriff's stations that we start or Bill Smith's backyard. But to bypass all of that doesn't make any sense. But you know, we had no control. And he just, I assure you that if we don't find her, we'll go back. They never did.
I know that you filed some complaints.
So I filed complaints because we had at the time what was called the Office of Independent Review. They have since been debunked, and part of the reason is because it was deemed that they were in bed with the sheriff's department, and that now this ha that had nothing to do with Mitrice's case,
Okay.
but she got caught up in all that. So these are the individuals who investigated Mitrice's case, and they basically cleared the LASD of any wrongdoing, right? So what happens is that in order for your complaints to be elevated, you have to, you know, so like first I had to do a complaint with the Internal Affairs, and then I had to do a complaint with the OIR. Like I had to like work my way up to finally get to the AG's office, the Attorney General. So you kind of have to go through all these steps. At the time, you know, these complaints were filed directly with the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department because that's where I had to start. And I was trying to be reasonable, knowing also that I'm a person naive of the law. And so my complaints were only, for the most part, based on common sense and my belief that they would represent some kind of violation of policy and or law, you know. So that's kind of what my complaints were. I didn't really think that anything would come of it from the LASD, but I needed to do that before I could move to elevate things to the next level. I want to go through those
Yes,
complaints
please do.
and just kind of summarize why. So one of the complaints I filed was against the deputy who answered the phone and who discouraged Latisse from making an immediate missing persons report when she requested that. There is no waiting period when you believe a person goes missing. You can file that report, and there is no waiting period. That is law and policy. So, to the extent that he told Latisse, oh, you should just wait. And when she even asked him, how long do I need to wait? He should have immediately told her, there is no waiting period to file a missing persons report. And her even making that statement meant that he needed to take that report immediately, and he didn't. So, imagine if he would have taken that report immediately. In the way that it should have been, and then it would have gone out to people, at least knowing that she was missing.
Right.
So he discouraged her. She eventually kind of pushed the issue several hours later and did it anyways. But so my complaint was because he violated law and policy. And so I believe that that was legit. He, by the way, was cleared of any wrongdoing. They deemed that that he acted reasonably in that regard, even knowing that that's a violation of law and
Yeah.
policy.
And they can basically tell you that, and you can't do anything about it, I guess. Or that's my question. You know, when they say we investigated this and we have cleared this person of any wrongdoing, where's the proof of your investigation? What does it involve? And if I know as a citizen that this is violating policy, then how do you not, you know, it just doesn't make sense.
So, and this, I'll share this part with you. So, in terms of the complaints that I filed, and there was 10 of them, after I filed the complaints, you know, there's this long waiting period, which they take months, you know, to respond. And so you just kind of, you have to keep nagging them, like, hey, where's my response? But at some point, and I don't know what happened to precipitate this, but at some point, the family put out a press release saying that they have learned that individuals are filing complaints and doing things on behalf of my trees, and that they basically that they don't appreciate that, or they don't condone that, and that they requested that the sheriffs do not provide that individual with any information. I'm going to assume that individual was me. I'm just going to make that assumption. And it really, so that really gave the sheriffs a lot of power.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, pride in being able to push back against me. And that allowed them to take an even longer time until I finally said, listen, this is a public matter. Those are my complaints. Irrespective of what anybody thinks, I am entitled to a response to those complaints. In trying to be agreeable, I said, if you want to state that you have such concern, you know, about the family and having compassion with the family that you want to respect their wishes, which makes no sense to me when someone was potentially murdered,
yeah.
I will accept just yay or nay. Did you find any wrongdoing? So you can just tell me that and I don't have to know the details. I told them that because they were already going to clear themselves anyway. I just needed to move to the next level. So I didn't, in that case, I probably would have known more of the details had the family not put out that press release. In my efforts to try to expedite getting a response, it's like, fine, give them the details. I don't really care. You're going to clear them anyway. So I just need to move on to the next level. So that really, unfortunately, put a little kink in things.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
But, yeah. But I continued my complaint. The next complaint, the field sobriety. I believe that one of those officers lied. One of them said that they did not order a field sobriety test, and the other one said that they did.
And then you have a witness that even said they didn't. So that's kind of two against one at this point.
Right. And then when they, okay, I've never been given a field sobriety test, but I've seen it on television.
Yeah, me too.
So the way at the deposition, when they were describing, Frank Brower was describing how he gave this field sobriety test, he kind of looked at her eyes and to see if she could follow. It's like, wait a minute, what about that straight line that you're supposed to?
Yeah.
Don't also do that. So no, he never did that, which is standard procedure for giving a field sobriety test, which is why the valet never saw that happening, because it didn't happen. And now he can say he looked at her eyes, but so that's the field sobriety test. I believe that one of those officers is lying, and I believe you're not allowed to lie under the color of authority. So that complaint was that somebody needs to investigate who was lying. When you have clear discrepancies in the written depositions that are contradicting one another, it's important to the public that we make sure that people are being honest in what they're purporting that they did. Somebody's lying, and that needed to be investigated. But they were both cleared of any wrongdoing.
And I think it's, you know, too, that blue wall of silence where they all protect each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, my opinion, but it does seem that way to me and a lot of other people, for sure.
Yeah. My another complaint I had was against Captain Thomas Martin for hiding the video. And I consider that suppression of evidence, because he pulled that video so quickly. And why we wanted that video originally is because they weren't searching for her. And so we needed to know, like, what direction do we go? There's only two ways out. You make a left or a right. And we wanted to know what direction that she walked, because we had no clue at that point, where to even begin the search. And so my belief is that him intentionally withholding that video was a suppression of evidence. And to the extent that he continued to lie about it to the family and to the media, there needed to be some consequences of that. And they deemed that there was no wrongdoing in that case. And like you mentioned earlier, he was promoted. Also, Sharon Cummins, the jailer, I filed a complaint against her, basically because she lied. She claims that she allowed Maitreese to use the phone. We later found out that the phone was broken. There's no way Maitreese could have used that phone. It's interesting. We happened to show up at a press conference when the telephone man was coming to fix the phone that had been broken. And this is before we saw the video. So on the video, you can tell she's never making a phone call. You can tell she's picking the phone up, but she keeps putting it down.
Yeah, because she knows it's not working.
Exactly. So she's like, you know, she can't do anything with that. And you can clearly see that. The LASD has yet to produce any evidence that she has made a phone call. So they can't even just pull the records from, you know, if she made an outgoing phone call, pull the record so we can say how, see how long she was on that phone. They have yet to do that. And later we find out that the phone was broken.
And it looks like they were trying to get somebody out there to fix it before y'all got there and realized that and could prove it and everything. It's wow.
Also, Sharon Cummins states that Maitrice was acting perfectly normal and there was nothing wrong with her. However, my complaint against her on that is that the individual that was in the jail with Maitrice was so bothered by Maitrice's behavior that she asked to be moved to a different cell. Now, we saw that happened on the videotape also. So that complaint was basically about her lying. That you knew that she had a mental health illness. You knew there was something going on with her mentally, which is why this person asked to be moved to a different cell, which you did. And we saw that happening on the video. Yet you didn't alert the watch commander that her behavior is acting odd. And maybe we need to get somebody down here to evaluate her. See, that would be that's a violation of Welfare and Institution Code 5150, where it's under your obligation to get her help if you feel like she needs that. Sharon Cummins was deemed to not have any wrongdoing. I have a complaint against Steve Whitmore. He's the spokesperson for the LASD, who, among many lies, one of the lies that he told publicly was that we couldn't hold her because the county had been sued for millions of dollars for over-detention. And so if we over-detained her, then we could get sued for millions of dollars. A couple of things. Lee Baca, previous to Steve Whitmore making the statement, said he did not understand why she was released. Because while we release people when it's time for them to go, it has to be prudent and safe to do so. So he himself said he didn't believe that it was prudent and safe to release a young woman or anyone in the middle of the night, no bus running, no car, no means to care. She probably didn't even know her car was missing, was gone.
Yeah, I thought about that too. I was like, she didn't even know that probably her car had been towed or anything.
So Steve Whitmore making the statement that we had to release her no matter what, even though they have a policy of prudence and safety, and that they had been sold for millions of dollars. I believe that that was a lie, and this is why I believe that. I had been pressing the now debunked Office of Internal Review. I had been pressing them for proof of how many millions of dollars that they were sued for over detention. They just kept putting me off. Finally, what happened? He sent an email. He accidentally push like reply to all, and it said just give her some numbers, and it was very like almost he didn't say to shut her up, but he might as well have said that. What happened is he tried to retract it, but I'd already opened it by the time.
Yes.
So they had to give me the numbers. It was somewhere around in a 3-year period of time it was over detention. It was no more than $5,000 over a 3-year period. And these were for clerical errors. They were like, this person really got over detained because someone literally put in wrong information and they were just paid out of petty cash. So I accused Steve Whitmore of colluding and lying on that issue of how many millions of loss, because he said that over and over and over again. But they cleared him of any wrongdoing. Ishmael Rodriguez, we talked about earlier, for him making the statement that he was the one who kept away from that nonsense. I believe that he was not acting as his duty as a peace officer to intervene. If he knows that someone is being harmed, if he knows that there is some malfeasance or criminal activity or something going on to harm someone, then it is his job to intervene. So I believe that there needed to be some investigation as to what he meant by that statement and what nonsense he was referring to, but he was cleared of no wrong. Now, they don't deny any of my complaints, by the way.
Yeah.
They just say that they acted reasonably. Also, Lieutenant Chu, when the arresting officer, Armando Luero, he sent an email. He was asked by Lieutenant Chu, why did you arrest her? And so Armando Luero sent an email to Chu saying, I arrested her because I was concerned for her safety, meaning that he knew something was wrong with her.
Yeah.
He was concerned for her safety and that she was acting ditzy. Nowhere in there just says, I arrested her because she was failing to pay an innkeeper or felony burglary or possession of less than an ounce of marijuana. It was she was acting ditzy and I was concerned for her safety. So Lieutenant Chu, once he received that email, what he should have done was publicly made the statement, she is missing. Our officer thought she was acting ditzy. We need to move her up from a voluntary missing adult, which is how they had her classified, to as a critically missing adult because this officer knew something was wrong with her. So the officer himself, I made a complaint against him for knowing, you know, that she was acting ditzy and she was a ding, as he referred to her. But also Lieutenant Chu, because he should have elevated her status to critically missing as soon as he got that word from. Now, Lieutenant Chu and Armando Luaro were also deemed as acting reasonably. I also have a complaint against Tui Wright, the head of the search and rescue, who I believe willfully, intentionally, and deliberately did not search the areas where Maitrice went missing. And that includes the so-called big search in January, as well as a search of when they did like a drone search, which, by the way, was initiated by one of our volunteers. We had to beg for that search, and they denied until they finally agreed to it. But Tui got to be the head of it, and we stayed and we were with them, and they searched everywhere, but not in the area where she was ultimately found and the area that he knows is a marijuana grow. So he, by the way, was deemed as acting reasonably. So those are my complaints. All of them were, while I don't have the details, in part due to the family's press release.
Which is disappointing and
it's unfortunate.
Sad.
It's unfortunate because I've been called many things. My nickname is Dr. Thug, is they refer to me as, which is whatever. Overzealous. The name calling, you know, whatever the names. I mean, there are many names for me.
Well, I'm going to call you inspirational, and you're admirable. You're brave. You're courageous. The things you are doing to find the truth about what happened to this young woman is just above and beyond. And I just commend you for that because there's so many people that don't have an advocate like you. And so for you to be doing these things is really brave. I mean, it really is, especially in this climate that we're in where we see police, you know, attacking people for doing much of nothing. It's very brave of you as a Black woman to be doing this. So I think you're the greatest. I do.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I don't feel alone in this. There are individuals who, most of the people who are the strongest advocates for Maitrice.
That's okay. I wish I could give you a hug. I'm so sorry.
Most of the people who are the strongest advocates for Maitrice at this point have never met her.
Yeah.
So that's just amazing to me. Like 13 years later, these bonds that I've made with people that I met over this tragedy for this person who I loved and cared about and just see that they're still there. So I don't feel... this is not my journey alone at all. You know, there's just a group of warriors who are determined, whatever that means.
Yeah.
That we're comfortable in however this turns out, and that every day we pretty much wake up and think about, you know, how do we fight for justice for Maitrice? Because it's not just about Maitrice. This is about justice for individuals who are faced with this type of behavior from law enforcement that is just unacceptable, that so many lives are ruined because officers either through deliberate or indeliberate means, you know, change the life, you know, of families. So we've all grown to see that it's, you know, Maitrice is this guiding light for many of us, but it's like she could help a lot of people, and she already has. So I'm not alone in that regard, and I don't want to take credit in that way, because I'm fully aware of the crew of people who, you know, I could pick up the phone and say, hey, this is what I want to do.
Yeah,
you
and know? They would be like, okay, I'm down, let's go.
Exactly, let's handle this.
Yeah, I had never heard of her story before, and I was looking up, I wanted to do a story on someone who... like an unsolved case, and hers just happened to come up. And of all the ones that I read, I kept going back to hers. Hers just kept pulling me. And it's cases like hers that I just get super attached to. There's certain ones that I just, And I think we all have that certain case where when we come across it, we just get so attached to it. And I feel like I know her. And it's so strange, but I do. Just reading about her and reading about her story and what happened to her and the mental health issues and stuff, I just feel like this could be some, this is like, okay, this is my best friend. I see her in my best friend or my cousin or this person or that person. And I just could not, I can't stop thinking about her. I literally go to bed wondering about her and what really happened. And the fact that I think we all deep down know or have an idea about what happened, will these people ever be held accountable?
You know, and when you say that, I just think, you know, reporters will often, and law enforcement will often refer to her case as a mystery. It's not a mystery. They know, I believe that they know whoever they is.
Yeah.
They meaning law enforcement. They know what happened to my trees. Otherwise, they wouldn't be taking these extreme measures to conceal information.
The fact alone about the 3-mile radius and not checking that spot ever is the biggest tell or red flag to me. Just that alone.
Even when they found her body. Okay, so the story is that we were supposed to go in and we were supposed to set, you know, make flowers and do a little memorial for her. My intention was to go and retrieve the rest of her bones because when the detectives themselves chose against the orders of the coroners to remove Maitreza's remains, they left many of her bones. So they just kind of scooped her up, the detectives themselves, put her in a body bag, scooped up the clothing, which, by the way, although they were women's clothing and they were more likely to hers, they didn't know that they were hers, but they put those in the body bag as well as hair that was all around.
Shouldn't those be put into separate evidence bags and not touched, you know, except by gloves and like very delicately handled, basically, and they were not.
No, they just put it all in the body bag. And so when they did that, I think at one point we had a forensic anthropologist who had been working with us, Clea Koth. And I told her, you know, I just don't trust these officers. So when they find Maitreza's body, and I believe that we would, because I believe that they knew where her body was, so that I felt confident that her body would be found eventually, because they'd get sick of us after a while. So I said, but I don't trust them. And so would you be willing to do, like, you know, a forensic examination when they find her body? And she agreed. And I think it was just more to make me feel better because I was a bit hysterical. Yeah. And but she did agree. And so the only time she happened to be in England at the time. And so she was flying back, but it was on the day of the funeral. And so I contacted, Maitreza's buried at Inglewood Cemetery. And I contacted the cemetery and said, you know, could someone do an evaluation there? And they said, we don't allow that anymore. And, you know, you just kind of beg. You got to do what you got to do. And so they did agree. They agreed. And so, you know, so we're at the funeral. We know that her body's going to be delivered after, you know, Mrs. Koth is done doing the evaluation, except I get a phone call from Clea Koth. And she says, Rhonda, you will not believe this, but the clothing is inside the body bag. And she doesn't look like she was ever examined in the first place. And I'm going to do the best I can to do as much as I can in the time that I have. So she, luckily, you know, she was able to secure the clothing in the way it should have been secured. She was able to do as much as she could. And then we had decided we're just going to have to bury her because the funeral was already going on. It was just a media circus. And we're just going to be mum's the word. She left the clothing at the cemetery. They agreed to that. And then we buried her. And then a couple weeks later, we just had a meeting with the coroner and said, we need to exhume her because you guys didn't evaluate her. And here's the proof. And and by the way, we said, do y'all know where the clothing is? Nobody knew where the clothing was except for us. And we were like, we didn't even want to tell them where the clothing was until on the day she was going to be exhumed. And then we would take them to get the clothing and take it to the crime lab.
And the thing is, wasn't the coroner the one that said no foul play? No, it didn't look like she had succumbed to the elements and her death was undetermined. Wasn't that
exactly
the coroner?
Exactly. So when they were challenged with how did you guys even identify her when you didn't even do the basic analysis that you're supposed to do, you can blame it. You know, they can blame it if they want on the sheriffs for dropping them into the wrong site. But at some point when you have all her bones, you're supposed to be doing your job, because originally they weren't, when the, you know, originally they were dropped into the wrong location, and which that's what gave the detectives the time to scoop her body up themselves. So they did exhume her, but you know, even that, what are we going to do? We don't know, you know, we know what they did wrong and what they didn't know, what they didn't do. And as far as her clothing goes, we were able to get that for the crime lab, but you know, they can say whatever they want, at those meetings. And I mean, you know, in those reports, but just the mere fact that that happened is like, how many, you know, how many blunders, you know, can a person make? And yeah. they claimed that when they were at the creek bed, that they believed, number one, they said they didn't have good reception, and that's why they weren't clear about what the coroner is.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me tell you something. I had a Boost mobile phone when I was down there. I had no problems with the reception. And yeah. So we got hiked into, although they did not want to hike us into the creek bed, Lee Baca ordered that they should take us there so that we could memorialize my trees. So we hiked into the creek bed under Tui Wright's direction. So what happens, we go down to the creek bed, and in one plot, one area, there's like a gully. And then there's another to the left, there's like a mound of dirt. That mound of dirt was like taped off with yellow tape. It would make you think that that's where her body was. By this time, I don't trust Tui as far as I can throw him. So I got an eagle eye on him. So while everyone else, meaning Latisse, Lauren, Kliakoff, they followed the search team members to the yellow tape, I followed Tui because I don't trust him. So I was like, Tui, why are you here in the creek bed, but everybody else is there? And he says, I don't know. I don't know why they're there. And I said, well, why are you here? And he goes, because this is where my tree was. And I said, well, how do you know? And he said, because I found my tree's body. I said, really? I thought the rangers found my tree. So then we just had this little staring contest. And then he called them over to the gully area. And I said, well, since you found her, how was her body found? And he goes, well, I can't tell you that, ma'am. And this is how I know the phone works. I called Commander Lopez at the time and said, could you please tell Tui to tell me how my tree is, you know, if he found my trees, could you tell him to tell me how her body was found? And he did. So then he described to me how my tree's body was found. Now, whether he found her body or not, I don't know if he was lying or what. Now, he also is the head of the eradication team, and he's also the person who chose to search everywhere except for the creek bed. But he described to me how her body was found, and it was pretty similar. Have you seen the mural?
Yes, yes.
The last image of the mural is how he described Maitreza's body. Now, if he was just messing with me to describe it that way, I don't know, but that is the way that he described her body, with leg up. I mean, just the same description. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
Just a lot.
So where do you go from here? What can we do as a community to help?
So what I really want is, a few weeks ago, maybe a month and a half ago, I'm not sure, I decided I'm getting old and I need to make sure I need to make sure that the information, as much of the information as I have, is publicly available, so that if I'm not around anymore, somebody can pick up this information. So the local Malibu did an article about my Teresa story, and she included like a link to all of the material that I have, my complaint to the AG's office, like pictures, images, emails, like everything that we've talked about today, like, is available. So it's a lot of pages.
I'm going to put the link to your data dump in the show notes, but it's also in the last episode about my trees. It's in those show notes too. I recommend everybody go look at that, because it will blow your mind to even go deeper and actually see it and read it for yourself.
And well, I'm hoping that, you know, a fresh set of eyes, you know, because I'm very close to the case. So, you know, somebody may see something, know something, remember something when they're reading. Some of what I've included are depositions. So out of the mouths of the people who were there, that I'm really hoping like a fresh set of eyes will really be able to maybe bring some different perspectives. Yeah. Also, some of these people are retiring. You know, maybe some folks will be willing to start talking because they don't have you know, much to lose anymore. But I don't want her story to be lost if I'm no longer available to advocate for her. And so I have released that information. Cece Woods, who she's the editor of the local Malibu. She's going to be doing a pretty extensive story in the next, I think, week or so. And it's about the entire Malibu kind of area and the other cases that have been unsolved. That would be the Malibu Creek shooting of Tristan Baudette, the missing status of Elaine Park, the missing status of Matthew Weaver. It also will include My Trees and some of the characters that continue to show up in very odd and bizarre ways in all of these cases. You know, I think that was, when that comes out, that would be a great source of information. I just really think that somebody's going to start reading some of these things and have a fresh perspective and or be compelled to come forward with information.
I really hope so. Because I'm right here, like, ready to break down and cry. So I cannot imagine going through this as long as you have. And just for me to sit here and just be honestly speechless. And I can't, I'm just mad. I'm sad, frustrated. I just can't imagine what you feel, yeah. You know?
For me, it's, you know, it's been 13 years. So yeah. I am... You know, there's certain times, you know, it still gets to you. That I'm not going to say that it doesn't. But I was fortunate to meet or have a conversation with this man once. And he is in a similar situation to me, where this woman, a friend of his, went missing, you know. And I think for him at the time I had met him, it had been 10 years. And I asked him, like, how do you keep going? Because I think My Trees had only been missing like a year. Like, I'm not going to be able to do this for 10 years. And he goes, you just have to ask yourself who you are as a person. And he said, so if you were driving down the street and you noticed someone had a flat tire, so you see this young woman, she had a flat tire, would you try to get them help? And I was like, yeah, you know, I'd probably call AAA, whatever. And then he said, well, after you call AAA or after you did that, then what would you do? And I was like, well, I'd probably just wait for them to get there and then make sure she was okay. And he said, that's what you do for My Trees. Oh. Some people wouldn't even stop. Some people would at least stop to make the phone call. But you know who you are. You're the person who's going to stick around to make sure she's safe. So if you put it in that perspective, it makes it a lot easier. And it really has. It really has. Like, yeah. I'm just going to stay here until I'm going to take care of you.
Wow. So. I just love you. I just love you. I'm going to cry. But I just think you are so... There are not enough people like you. There really isn't. And I'm so glad that My Trees has had a voice through you. I'm sorry. I'm a very emotional person. Yeah. I'm very sensitive. And like I said, this case has really been on my mind. She's been on my mind a lot. And just you being her voice and trying so hard.
I do want you to know that it's my pleasure to advocate for My Trees. It's my pleasure and my honor. I don't, it's, for me, it's not a burden. It's not a mission.
Right.
I feel very guided by her. So it's not, she has a lot to give the world. And since she's not here physically, I feel like oftentimes she guides me to, and she's helped so many people, you know. I mean, she's provided me with so much knowledge. You know, I do a lot of advocacy work for other families who have missing and mentally ill loved ones. So to be able to provide that information and work, and I feel really competent, you know, about it now. And to be able to say, hey, this is what you do next, or this is what should happen. And, you know, doing that is so rewarding.
Yeah, when maybe families or loved ones are kind of lost on where to go, it's like you've been there, so you know where to guide them.
Yeah, and just saying, this is the way it's supposed to work. And I'm, you know, to be able to do that very quickly now, and I have other people who I've trained to be able, you know, to work with families. And And I also am really excited. I have not shared this yet, but I'll share it with you. I'm
Okay.
really excited that, so sometimes when, I'll go out and I'll speak to people about what to do when someone goes missing. And, sometimes children are there. And I always thought that'd be really, I wish it was a book that I could give to kids. So I wrote a
Yeah.
children's book. I am not a writer.
Oh.
I wrote a children's book and I wrote it many years ago. It's actually a 3-part series. I wrote it many years ago, like maybe 6 years ago. And I had interest in with some publishers and everything, but they, like they didn't like Maitreza's name and they didn't like the characters in that children's book are families. They are families that have touched me and I've worked with those families. And so I'm attached to the names, I'm attached to the characters. And so I just wasn't willing to give it up, but I'm also very lazy. And I'm this self-publishing thing didn't make sense to me. Finally, about 6 months ago, my friend has convinced me to self-publish, and I have, and I got a wonderful illustrator and I had a great editor. And so I'm going to release the children's book. It's called Amber Goes Missing. And I'm going to release it on Maitreza's birthday, which is April 30th. Coming up.
Yes.
So Amber Goes Missing. It's so one of the characters in the book is Amber Dubois. I don't know if you knew her story.
Yes. Yes. I know her father came out to help and,
yes.
to look for her.
And so, oh my gosh, he was just so helpful to you. Such a helpful. And so she's one of the, characters.
Yeah.
I'm in touch with Carrie. I know, Mo's moved on to Hawaii or wherever he's gone and Carrie's still doing, her work, with her organization to help with search dogs and everything. And so that book, it's like, I wanted the book to be named after Maitreza, except the story took me to this place where it was about, I won't tell you, but Amber needed to be, Amber had to be the main character in that book. And it's just a delightful story. And I'm very happy to have a wonderful illustrator to just bring this is like how I wanted it to look. So I'm very excited about that. But more excited, I can hand this out when I'm at events to kids in a way that is informative to them. And it tells a story that could happen in their real life. So,
yeah, not enough kids are educated about this kind of stuff.
Right.
And that's something that I've thought a lot about, but I never thought about a children's book. And I think that is wonderful. What do you think the reading age on this book is?
Somewhere 6 to 9.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's in that. And it's a very non, the books that I have read about, how to, if someone goes missing, they always have animals, like these bears get lost in the woods.
Yeah.
So I really wanted something that was real that the kids could relate to. So I'm just really excited about that. So I'll have to make sure you get your hands on that.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I would read that to all of my little cousins.
Mm-hmm. And it's very non, I think it's an easy read for them. Like it's not something that's intimidating or anything, but I go out a lot and I'm around kids a lot and it's nice to I want them to understand that, but understand what you would do. But I have to share with you also, Maitreza wanted to work with children. So I feel like I am not a writer. I honestly feel like I was so guided to do that on her behalf and in her honor, because that was her thing.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
Oh, that just gave me chill bumps, but good chill bumps.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh.
We're going to keep trucking.
Yeah. So do you think that the public can call anybody and write anyone to be like, okay, we feel like this is wrong. What is there anything we can do?
There's a number that they can call. Certainly my email, drrhondahampton@yahoo.com, that I've had that email. I've kept that email, in case someone wants to contact me anonymously. I know over the years when people have tried to call the sheriff's department and leave a tip, it's not always been the great experience. So I've left my email available. Also, I'm on social media. So if someone wants to DM me, and then the 1-800 number, certainly someone could call that. That is only monitored by me. No one else has that. That all of that can be anonymous.
The 1-800 number will be in the show notes for everybody.
And sometimes people just want to contact me to just express their feelings. And that I'm a shrink. So what am I going to do? And I think that is fine too, because that gives me energy. I was like, okay, people still care.
Yeah.
This still does impact people and it's not, hers, she still impacts people. So.
Well, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you want to talk about before we close out?
I think you know about the documentary.
No, I don't.
Okay.
So this would be news for me.
Okay. So I think I told you about, a volunteer. Well, his name is Chip Croft, right? So when my trees first went missing, we would call press conferences, right? So on this one particular day, we called a press conference. It was pretty early on, maybe within 3 weeks of her going missing. So, and we called it to at the main headquarters, right, in East LA at the time. When I arrived there, this gentleman walked up to me and he says, you know, they're turning the press away and saying that there's no press conference. And I was like, really? So only one of the vans got through. And the rest of them were being turned away. So we had no press coverage at the time. And so he said, you know, if you like, I can pull out my camera. Well, see me, I thought he meant he was going to take pictures.
Yeah. That's what it sounded like, for sure.
Yeah. All of a sudden he has this equipment. And it was like, it looked just like, it was like a camera with all the things. And so he videotaped it. And it was great because we weren't getting we would get coverage, but it would not be in a way that was helpful to my trees. It was all more in support of the sheriff's department and not telling the whole story. So when he pulled out that camera, I thought, this is magic. And so what he would do is anytime we did an event, he would videotape it and then he would put it on YouTube. And honestly, that is the way that we began to change public opinion. That is the way we were able to get the entire story out. And then because of that, we began to get more support from the general public, and then the media began to turn around. Well, there was over the years, there was so much of this YouTube stuff. I was like, gosh, we should just like combine this so people could just go to one place. And so he happened to be a documentary filmmaker, not really wanting to do that for my Teresa's case. That's not what the plan was, but I thought it doesn't have to be like some big documentary. Let's just, you know, kind of get it together so we can. But we didn't have the money to, you know, send it out to be edited correctly. But he had taught editing. And I thought, if you can show me how to edit and we could just do it together. So he took a couple months, I think, to show me how to even edit. And then luckily our time frames, like he's a night person and I'm a morning person. So I would look at things and then I would shoot it to him. And then when I would wake up, like we just kind of did this for several months. We were able to get a documentary. It's called Lost Compassion. It won a couple awards.
Oh, which my gosh.
Yeah, because he knew how to enter those. And
that's awesome.
Which was great because the story gets out. And what's nice about having that is it's something that we can refer people to say, look at their terrain. Look at,
yes. Like,
this is not just, this is what it looked like. This is what the searches look like. This is what people were saying at the time. So anyways, it's called Lost Compassion. It's available on Vimeo.
Oh, good.
So yeah, so pretty easy to access. And it just chronicles kind of our story and kind of just talks about what we went through. So.
I'm going to watch that tonight because I had no idea. So that is amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you want to get out there?
I do think it's interesting. You know about the mural, right?
Yes.
So one of the things I think that's interesting about the mural is, so when we first found, well, I didn't, one of the volunteers found the mural. And so immediately we want to know who did this mural. Like, you're doing it on, when you know we're doing a search, highly publicized search, everybody knows where we're going to be. And all of a sudden this mural, freshly painted mural, comes up. So we find it. So we asked one of the commanders at the time, like, you guys need to go after this person. And so they finally came back to us and said, oh, well, the person who did this mural is from South Central Los Angeles. I'm like, really? Okay, somebody gonna drive all the way from South Los Angeles to the hills of, you know, Santa Monica Mountains to paint a mural that no one's gonna see. Like, okay, I don't believe it. So I kept pushing and pushing and pushing. But you know what happened? How I found out who did it is I was on that magazine site, Vice, if you're familiar with Vice. And somebody, this is my trees working for me, right? Some small little article came up with some guy making some comment about some mural that he had seen in Malibu. So I went and looked at that mural and I thought, okay, well. And then he says the same person did the mural in Montanito. So I got in touch with that person.
Yeah.
You need to come up with some names. And that's how I found out who the individual was who did it. And he had communicated to me that he knew nothing about my Teresa's case, which I know is a lie. And he was not familiar with the area, which I also know is a lie. And that mural that he did was just a Keith Haring rendition. I'm like, I'm familiar with Keith Haring. I don't really think that that's a Keith Haring rendition.
Yeah.
But okay, what am I going to do? Anyways, he had turned himself into law enforcement.
I was wondering if he was the one that was...
He turned himself in with his... well, prior to me even contacting him, he turned himself in with his attorney. And they just let him go. And they said that they thought that he was honest in the case with Mitrice Richardson. And so he was cooperative. So they let him go. And I was like, well, did he say why he painted the mural? He says what he told them was he painted it because he had an afro and he liked afros. This is a white guy with red hair, but okay.
Oh my God.
But, and I said, y'all couldn't even charge him with whatever you charge people for vandalism, like even the $500 that you're supposed to. So they let him go for who knows why. And so whatever his story is about why he did the mural is what they're going to accept. And that's just, so I guess the thing is, like, when I say, I don't know what happened to Maitrice, there's a lot of players. He would be one of them. Why would you do that mural on that day? Is it just a coincidence or not? And why are the police protecting you? Why didn't you at least get a fine? There's just lots of little threads like that. That just, like, I have a suspect list.
Yeah. I bet. There is no reason that they should have let that guy go. Do they know this boy? What was the reason for not investigating him further? Is it just lazy police work? Or is it, do they know more? That's, you know.
Right. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, I know we could sit here and be like, okay, what if and why and da da da. I just really hope the truth does come out when people start retiring and somebody needs to get brave, like grow some balls, be a man, come forward and tell what you know. Because if this was your daughter, your sister, your mother, your grandmother, your aunt, anybody, you would want answers and it's not fair.
Mm-hmm. I know this one, and I really hope people can jump on board and really just, you know, dive into her story, because if this isn't solved before I'm not around, when I'm not around anymore, I definitely want people to continue to make these individuals uncomfortable until the day that they die. And I know many of them are uncomfortable. I know that they're on my Find My Trees page. I know that they read, you know, I will have the occasion to pop a picture up there and this is what so-and-so is doing. And, you know, at the very least, let's make them uncomfortable for as long as we can and until someone comes forward. Because somebody knows.
Yeah.
Somebody knows.
And the thing about it is, the sheriff that was there when all of this happened, he went to prison, correct? I think I read this document of him going to prison and a lieutenant, or I think it was a lieutenant.
So Sheriff Baca and Sheriff Lee Baca and Paul Tanaka and I believe 22 others all went to jail for corruption. So at the time that Maitrice's case, you know, was being investigated, it's in the middle of this very corrupt, and it's still corrupt department, where that's what they did. They protected one another. They lied for one another. They eventually got caught. And Lee Baca just got out of jail, I think, like a year and a half ago. But yeah, many of them were marched to jail. Many of those individuals who have already done jail time had direct oversight of Maitrice's case. So now they didn't go to jail for what they did to Maitrice, but they went to jail for other corruptive actions that the FBI knew and could prove happened. So we're not talking about a department that has clean hands, which is why we have an OIR that was the head of overseeing that Maitrice's case was dealt with properly. They got debunked because of their corrupt behavior in a department where the head, you know, many, many, many of the higher ups were in federal prison. And we're supposed to accept that the outcome of Maitrice's case was thoroughly investigated?
Yeah, no.
No way. Subsequent to Lee Baca, then, you know, you still have those guys who retired before they went to jail. One of which is Chief Neil Tyler, who, while his buddies all went to jail, he retired but came back to the department to serve in some like part-time capacity. So he kind of continued to have his hands in Maitrice's case while his buddies were in jail. And one of the things that he told me was, you know, regarding my complaints is like, you know, Rhonda, we don't know what to do with you because we're not used to dealing with...
We've never had anybody push back and question us, basically.
Pretty much, right? But he's like, we're not used to having people, you know, question an investigation when there's already been a lawsuit that was settled, because the parents did settle a lawsuit for, it was actually for the removal of her remains against the orders of the coroners, but they settled that. But, and then, and particularly like, you're not a family member. So basically like, we paid the family off and they're gone. So why don't you leave? He might as well have just said that.
Exactly.
But he was the one, you know, he was still around. He was still, you know, having his hands in my Teresa's case and outwardly telling me, he told me this, Rhonda, we don't need to investigate our officers because these are all really good men. He told me that probably about 4 months before their asses went to jail. And the department has continued to be corrupt. We're in between sheriffs right now, but our current sheriff, Alex Villanueva, he came and spoke. I did like a 10-year, kind of like a celebration of all the volunteers who were still around and, you know, supporting my tree. So there's like, I don't know, around 50 people like still there. Right. And so we had this luncheon and it was really at the church where her services were, and he came. Right. And so the first time he spoke was at that small intimate gathering. Right.
Okay.
So what he said was, he was only invited to come to the luncheon. I didn't ask him to speak. But he stood up and he, you know, he's very moved. And he said, we're going to get down to the bottom of this. I'm going to investigate this thing from top to bottom. And, you know, everybody's going wild. It's like, we're not used to a sheriff doing that. And so it was like, wow. Even afterwards, I said, Alex, like, that's going to be tough, because he was new sheriff. And I was like, your boys don't want this case to be settled. So that's a pretty bold statement to make. But he assured me, fine. A week later, at a press conference, which was on the day that she had actually gone missing, you know, 10 years later, he stands up there and he makes a statement that this case has been thoroughly investigated. There's been 3 investigations. They've all deemed the same thing. And therefore, I don't feel like anything doesn't need any further investigation. Now, believe the media who was there challenged him, because they had already been there the previous week when he said he was going to. So I was so angry. So he's being bombarded with questions by the media. And so what does he do? He has to leave. His press person tells him, you know, he's got to get out there. So now I'm standing there. It's like, I am going to get reamed. I'm like, there's no way I'm going to get. So, you know, they're being nice until someone says, how do you feel about, you know, what he said? I just lost it.
I don't blame you.
Yeah.
It seems like maybe somebody got in his ear.
Oh, yeah.
Possibly maybe a threat or something. Or
he later told me that he was getting a lot of pushback from the homicide detectives about, you know, about reinvestigating her case, and that he was getting pushback. In fact, what happened was, after that press conference, the media is still asking lots of questions, and I was getting summoned to come and talk to him, which I refused. Right. So finally, what they did is they got a friend of mine to say, hey, Rhonda, come here. And so she takes me to this back room and he's there. And I was so angry. I lost it. I lost it. And what it kind of ended with, dude, you are the head of one of the largest sheriff's department or law enforcement agencies in the United States. And you're going to tell me that you can't tell those boys to solve her case? Because why? So, and I just had to leave. And he subsequently, you know, he's kind of told me that he just has got a lot of pushback. So what? They're supposed to do their job. And I told him, you don't have a problem with that. You don't have a problem with you ordering somebody to investigate a case and they give you pushback and you're the sheriff? You should be concerned about that. That is why her case needs to be turned over to the FBI, because he could make that call. It needs to be out of their hands, and it needs to be, you know, it needs to be in the hands of the FBI, because these guys are very clear. They don't want to do it, and he didn't have the balls to make them.
Exactly. That is so weak. If you're a sheriff and you let these people push back on you like that to the point where you're like, okay, I won't, then you are just a coward.
You know what he finally did? And I wouldn't talk to him after that. So I was so angry. And so finally what he did was he assigned a detective, Stephanie Schrout, to, I say, pacify me. Okay. So he didn't want to look bad. Right. Because now you're caught. And so he assigned her. But honestly, all it was her proving to me everything that I said was wrong. Even when I said, like, for example, I said, Tui Wright told me that he found Mitrice's body, yet the ranger said they found her body. She said to me, the detective, Rhonda, it's just that you hang on everybody's words. And so when he said that he found her body, he meant we, the sheriffs, found her body. I said, okay, but we, the sheriffs, didn't find her body. this rangers found her body. And but you know, she would play games like that with me, and yeah, I was like, he's in heat. You can say that I hang on every, but that's your job. Your job is to hang on people's words. That's what we do. When you say I found the body, I want to know why you said that. So however you guys are twisting it around is what makes me suspect, you know, suspicious of all of you. And so that's kind of how it went with her. So he will get the credit for saying that he found that he did assign another detective, but she was just a joke.
Man.
Just a joke.
So I cannot remember, but has the FBI looked into this case at all? Is there a way for them to, or
if the sheriff requested it? So they can request the assistance. And what happened is early on, Lee Baca lied. Lee Baca, we were in a meeting with him, and he says, well, you guys want me to request the FBI? Then I'll request the FBI. He gets up from the meeting. He goes. He's gone for about maybe 15 minutes. He comes back and says, okay, the FBI said they'll go ahead and take the case. We were all excited. Later, we find out he didn't even make a phone call to the FBI. He was just saying that to shut us up. Any of the sheriffs could request. That, you know, just based on they can put a case together to say there is so many internal inconsistencies in this case. There appears to be a pattern of lying to this family, and we need assistance in this case. We're not capable of investigating it on our own. Or they could assign it to a cold case evaluation team. In that case, someone can have access to all, you know, of the information, but they have no interest in doing that.
And that's because, in my opinion, you would do it unless you had something to hide.
And it's been 13 years. How is it going to hurt you to let cold case investigators come in to ask, plea for help from the FBI? Like you, and you know your department is dirty because they've gone to federal prison for it.
Yep.
So
this is tough.
It is a lot.
You're a tough person to even, you know, so many people wouldn't have made it as far as you, as, you know, as far as sticking in there, because this is tough to be turned down at every corner and try to do something new. And then they still find a way to give you the runaround and just kind of, like you said, pacify you.
Yeah. And then unfortunately, so it was Lee Baca. The next sheriff was Jim McDonald. Unfortunately, Jim McDonald and Kamala Harris were pretty close to each other. So even when I finally got to the point where I could plea and I sent like this big, it was almost 500 page report, you know, complaint to Kamala Harris, she initially came back and said, no, that, you know, this is before Jim McDonald came into office. It's sort of like towards the end of Lee Baca's term. You know, she said, you know, this department is fine and they're making lots of great changes. And, you know, we don't see, which has nothing to do with my Teresa's case, by the way. And so no, we're not going to. And then about a week or two after she made that statement is when Lee Baca admitted that he lied to the feds and he was going to have to go to jail, right? Mm-hmm. And then Michael Richardson, my Teresa's dad, sends another letter appealing to Kamala Harris saying, hey, you know, now she's going to have to do something because your boy, who you said is making some really great changes in the department, admitted that he lied to the FBI. And the dad is asking you. So then, and also at this point, she was running for... What was she running for at the time? So she was running for Senate at this time. So she didn't look that great in LA. So people were like, you didn't support my tree. So so when she sends a letter to Michael saying, hey, yeah, we're going to investigate it without any explanation as to why, Michael and I, he won the bet. But I was like, okay, I'm going to give her like a month after she gets elected, when she finally closes the case, right? And says there was no wrongdoing. And Michael's like, no, I'm going to give her 2 weeks. So he won. Within 2 weeks or so of her, you know, winning her bid, then, you know, they come back and say there was no wrongdoing. And here's the thing too, she used my trees in her wiki page and in her campaign. Like she used my trees story to
advertise
herself.
That's disgusting.
Yeah.
That's disgusting.
Yeah. Now after she gets elected, she wipes all that clean. We all have screenshots. So you can imagine, you know, when she is being chosen to run for vice president, it was like, wow, this is so unbelievable. And maybe she has more connections in that area. Like her husband was raised in that area, in the area where my trees went missing. So who knows what connections people have.
Yeah. Like you said, there are so many threads. There's so many people involved in every one of these cases that has happened around there.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. And you know, if there are any updates, like, let me know. I'm going to be following the page closely so I can watch you make the police uncomfortable and, you know, just keep doing what you do. And I admire you so much. And I'm just honored that you came. So thank you so much.
I appreciate you also. I don't often like doing podcasts, but I just got a really good energy. I got a good feeling from you. So I was like, I'm just going to do it. Like, something feels good about it. So I'm going to just use my gut going forward.
But, thank you.
Thank you so much.